Today's reading is from Romans chapter 1, starting at verse 28, and it can be found on page 1132 of the Church Bibles. Romans 1, verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. Therefore you have no excuse, O man. Every one of you judges, for in passing judgments on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who do such things. Do you suppose, O man, you who judge those who do such things, and yet do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God?
Jeff, thank you very much indeed, and may I add my welcome to you. It is mauve and fits all sizes. It has motion sensors in the fabric of the right elbow that recognise movement. It has a filament in the left elbow that moves and changes electrical resistance, sending wireless signals to a nearby computer. The sensor in the left arm converts the arm position to a place on an electronic fretboard in the computer, and the sensor in the right arm converts the strumming motion of the right arm into a guitar riff that would make Jimmy Page quiver in his retirement home. And it is, as you may have read last week in the papers, the high-tech T-shirt developed in Australia in order to enable any air guitarist to convert his or her dreams into reality. Now, I'm sure when you read about the wearable instrument shirt last week, you probably did not add it to your Christmas list as one of your essential necessities. It's more of an executive accessory, I guess, than a basic necessity. It would be an ideal present, perhaps, for one or two rather eccentric weirdos. Those who've just returned from the International Air Guitar Festival, for example, might want it somewhere lurking in the bottom of their Christmas stocking. But really, for any run-of-the-mill normal individual like you or me, the wearable instrument shirt is not something that we're going to be after. My experience is that for many here in the city, Jesus Christ is considered in similar terms. Yes, he's fine for the eccentric minority. The really needy, they need Jesus. I can understand why Saddam Hussein might need Jesus right now, or perhaps John Prescott in the summer needed Jesus and his forgiveness. The guy who sells the big issue, yes, they need Jesus. But for the ordinary run-of-the-mill, decent individual like you or me, he is not essential. Indeed, when I was talking about this series that we're just beginning today, last Tuesday, one of you said to me, of course, we really see Jesus as a panacea for the morally needy. Well, my aim in this series is for us to see that Jesus Christ is much more than an executive accessory. Jesus Christ is the basic necessity for every single human being who has ever walked the earth. The most hardened atheist needs Jesus. The most successful high flyer needs Jesus. The everyday plodder needs Jesus. My client needs Jesus. The man or woman at the next door desk needs Jesus. My wife needs Jesus. I need Jesus. And you need Jesus. And we're going to be in Romans chapter 2, because Paul's aim in Romans chapter 1, 2, and 3 is to convince us of the absolute necessity of Jesus Christ and the forgiveness he offers. And these two chapters, Romans 2 particularly, will cause us to approach Christmas valuing the forgiveness that Jesus Christ brings to us. First then, from today's reading, there is no excuse, and secondly, there is no escape. The scene in verse 1 of chapter 2, which would be helpful if you have open in front of you on page 1132, the scene in chapter 2, verse 1, is from the courtroom. The word excuse, you have no excuse, means literally to speak yourself off, to talk yourself out of it, to make a defense. As I read verses 1 to 3, you can see the target audience. Let me read it, and you will see the target audience all too easily. Therefore, you have no excuse, no defense, O man, every one of you who judges, for in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, practice the very same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who do such things. Do you suppose, O man, you who judges those who do such things and yet do them yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? So the scene is the courtroom, and the target audience is obvious, isn't it? In the dock is any man or woman who's ever looked at another human being and passed judgment. It's the person who says, well, at least I'm not as bad as X. I'm tempted to say, in the dock are the great and the good. And I was thinking of saying that all through until late last week, when it struck me that actually that's rather unfair on the great and the good. Because it doesn't matter really whether we look out on the world from behind the shutters of our drawing room in a country estate, or the net curtains of our lounge in a two-up, two-down housing estate. We can still be, O you who judges. And therefore, what Paul is encouraging us to do, those of us who pass judgment, is to step down from the bench for a moment, to take off the wig, to take our place in the dock, to listen to the evidence, and to realize that there is no excuse, no talking ourselves out of it. The therefore in verse 1 at the start of this chapter demands that we look at what has been said previously. When you see a therefore, you're always asking yourself, what is it therefore? And in chapter 1, verses 18 through to chapter 1, verse 32, Paul has painted a picture of a culture on which God has given up. And if you were here in our Advent series this time last year, you will remember that we went through the graphic description of a culture given over by God in judgment. And three times in verses 18 to 32, Paul spells out the marks of a culture on which God has given up, that is, as he says, under the wrath or the judgment of God. And he explains that God acts in judgment on those who reject him. So look at verse 22. Claiming to be wise, people became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images, resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Verse 24. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. So as we reject God and push him to the sidelines, God acts in judgment and gives humanity over to promiscuous sex. Verse 25, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped the truth and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever, amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. So as we reject God, as a culture pushes God off to the sidelines, God, in judgment, will hand that culture over to perverted sex. And then verse 28, since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God that gave them up to a debased mind, and the reading from today. As we reject God and push him off to the sidelines, so our mind, which was created by God to be informed by God with decisions in line with God's absolute perfect will, our mind becomes debased. It has no gold standard, if you like, to form right opinions. And therefore God gives us over as we reject him to a debased mind. Promiscuous sex, therefore, will be the hallmark of a culture under God's judgment. Rather than seeing the opposite sex as another human being made in the image of God to be honoured and respected and treated as something precious made in the image of God, we will start to see the opposite sex as a piece of meat to be used for my own sexual gratification. You may have read this weekend that in Edinburgh, the student body have banned the Christian Union for running a course entitled Pure Sex that encourages people to treat the opposite sex with honour and respect. Well, that's a sure sign, isn't it, of a culture under God's judgment. So too is perverted sex the sign of a culture under God's judgment. It will become normal as we reject God. Paul calls it unnatural sex. We talked about it at length last year. You don't need a PhD in physiology to work out that medically the male body is not designed to be penetrated by the male sexual organ. To argue that it is quite simply to deny the facts of life. The physical damage and disease, not to mention the psychological disorder that is caused by denial of the most basic facts of life, has to be seen to be believed. And talk to any family doctor, and they will tell you the damage that is done by perverted sex. It's just the media doesn't like to publish it. I see in the paper this morning that the Home Office is busy forwarding more legislation for this spring to normalise what Paul calls unnatural sex. Only a culture on which God has given up would want to do such a thing. And finally, the marks of God giving up on a culture is a depraved mind, which is spelt out in verse 29 to 31. And get hold of the Chelsea-Barcelona match or the Arsenal-West Ham match or just about any Premiership match. Watch it for a few seconds and you will see in glorious technicolor the depraved mind worked out in front of your eyes. So that's revision from the series from last year. We spent a lot longer on it last year. That is the revision. Here is Paul's argument. Do you not agree, O morally upright man or woman of the City of London, that such things are wrong? Well, of course we do. I mean, sexual promiscuity is one of the greatest threats to our so-called civilization. As we see the breakdown of the family, you talk to any teacher from any of our inner city schools and they will tell you the extraordinary damage that is being done by the breakdown of the family. Surely you agree such things are wrong. Do you not agree that the acts of the debased mind that are outlined in verses 28 to 31 are wrong? Is that not what the entire judicial system of our country is set up to prevent and work against? You know, the morally upright person certainly agrees that such things are wrong. That's what makes the morally upright person morally upright. So says Paul, O man or woman, every one of you who judges, you know these things are wrong, but you do them. So there is no excuse. Let's just go back to verse 24 for a moment and have a look at one or two of the things that Paul mentions. And let me tell you that I have found this chapter deeply personally convicting. Verse 24, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts. I'm tempted to say, stand up, the man who knows no lust in his heart. as the new girl arrives in the office and walks through the trading floor in her short skirt and low-cut blouse, "Tell me, O judging man, that you have known no lust in your heart. Were there a window in the imagination of your mind, and were there to be a camera fixed on it, and were the film to be played just up here, right now, or maybe at your office party, or perhaps on Christmas Eve, in front of your family?" Therefore you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges, for in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself. Let's look in a little depth at the list that flesh out the debased mind in verse 28 to 31. The debased mind, verse 29, will be filled with all manner of evil and covetousness and malice. There's a man in our square where I live who wants to live in my house. He tells me just about every time we meet. He says, "I want to move in to your house." So much so that I had to say to him when we were away a couple of weeks ago, as we met on the street, just with me with my bag, it was obvious, I said, "I'm going away for a little while. Stay out." That is to covet, isn't it? To want what somebody else has got. I don't deserve it. He probably deserves it far more than me, but he covets it. "Tell me, O judging man, that you have never coveted." The debased mind will envy, it will feel pain as another is promoted above it. It will feel jealousy as it listens to another's holiday plans or schooling proposals or employment success or annual reward. "Tell me, O judging man, that you have never envied." Of course you have. Therefore there is no excuse. The debased mind will be full of strife. "Tell me you've never lost it. Or you've never got so involved in an argument that you've thought to yourself as you walked away, I'm going to find a way to get back into that argument because I know what I should have said, and if I'd said it, I would have absolutely trashed the individual." Of course you have. The debased mind will seek to deceive, it will hide the truth, it will flatter in order to influence, it will reveal only half the truth or part of the truth when it knows that the whole truth will cause personal disadvantage. The debased mind will gossip and slander. "Tell me that you have never had that conversation. You know, I really like her, but..." The debased mind will be arrogant and haughty. I found myself at an airport this summer looking out on other families down my nose. I think I probably was actually looking down my nose. If you'd had a film of me at Bristol Airport this summer, I think you would have seen me looking down my nose as I thought, what do they do with their children? It's not surprising, is it, that my friend has said this is one of the most convicting chapters in the whole of the Bible. The argument is irrefutable. We know that such things are wrong. That's why we pass judgment on the other. But as we pass judgment on the other for doing them, what are we doing? Well, we're condemning ourselves, aren't we? Verse 1 alone, it seems to me, blows the cover. One of my jobs when I was in the army, one of the things you had to do on occasion was to go with a soldier. If you're an officer, you used to have to go and make character defence of a soldier who had done something naughty and been arrested, and a particular rifleman had been accused of knifing somebody, and I was to give character witness for him because he claimed to be innocent. For 6 months he claimed to be innocent. Over and over and over again he claimed to be innocent. He insisted on his innocence. We grilled him, and he got to Winchester Crown Court, and a barrister dressed up in all his stuff took him into a room, and he came out before the court case saying, "Fair cop, I did it." And of course at that moment Rifleman Stevenson's plea changed from one of not guilty to one of guilty. And as his plea changed, so he sought mercy, not justice. I think verse 1 is one of those instances, isn't it? The judging person tends to be the person who's walking around frequently saying, well, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. And Paul says, well, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges, for impassing judgment on another. You condemn yourself because you, the judge, practice the very same thing. But not simply no excuse, is it? Paul doesn't leave it there, and in the last couple of minutes, let me dwell on the no escape. For if we know that God simply must judge, if we know that there can be no ultimate justice anywhere, if at the end of time there isn't some calling to account, if we judge on the basis that there must be a judgment, then, verse 2, there will be no escape. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls on those who do such things. Of course you do. So then, do you suppose, O man, you who judge, that you will escape? The wicked man says in his heart, God has forgotten, God has hidden his face, God will never see. But the judging person knows that God hasn't forgotten, and the judging person knows that God does see, and that the judging person knows that there is no hiding from God. And so the judging person, in his judgment, acknowledges in his mind that there must be a final judgment. And if you acknowledge in your mind that there must be a final judgment, and you pass judgment on somebody else, even as you pass judgment on somebody else, you're announcing the fact that there will be no escape for yourself. As a sixth former in the school I went to, I was a prefect, and we weren't especially sort of fascist body, us prefects who ran the disciplinary side of the school, but we did run people in for breaches of the rules fairly frequently. I mean, it was a boarding school and people were always breaking the rules. But in the sixth form, myself and another other prefects had a small club, and we had found a room with a particularly favourable prevailing draught that meant that one could smoke quite happily whilst sitting by the window. And several of us used to meet after lunch and in the evening and so on fairly regularly through the day as the draught blew the smoke out of the room, which happened to be my room. I was vice head of the prefect body in my particular section of the school, and the evidence was neatly stored away under the sofa seat, which lifted happily off the sofa. One weekend I was away for the weekend, and on my return, the housemaster of the house in which I lived summoned me to his office, stood in front of me with an enormous plastic bag, held it by the bottom, emptied it, and vast quantities, the like of which I had no idea were in the sofa, of Marlborough Lights or whatever it was, poured out onto the floor. And he announced, Taylor, what is this? There was no excuse. I knew the law. I couldn't plead ignorance. In fact, I had been busy upholding the law, and I knew that punishment had to come. There could be no escaping judgment. In fact, I'd spent my time as a prefect making sure that people faced judgment. And so there was no escape. Well, the aim of this series is to move us from pleading innocence to seeking mercy. The aim of this series is that as we approach Christmas, those of us who are Christian find ourselves saying, what a gift! What a gift! You shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sin. And the aim of this series is that those of us who are looking into the Christian faith find ourselves saying, I need just one thing, Jesus Christ. Let's pray. God shows his love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. So we praise you for this indescribable gift. We praise you for this precious pearl. We praise you for this great treasure. We praise you that whilst Jesus became poor for our sakes, in him we can become rich. We ask, living Lord, that he might be a treasure to each of us, for your name's sake. Amen.